Hello, welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius Nomdaron, your host. Today, I have an interesting guest, a lady who's autistic, who is a professor, who has written a number of books, is very experienced in the mechanics of animal husbandry, and has just written a fascinating book called Visual Thinking during the lockdown period. And I really wanted to get Temple Grandin onto the show to talk through the background behind this book and what motivated her to do this book. Temple Grandin, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Great to be here.
I'm actually on a building site right now. My house is a building site while I'm doing this podcast. I'm at the moment putting in a wood-burning stove in my house, and this podcast got interrupted and delayed because I'm busy working with a roofer to put in the liner and so on.
You know, you said roofers were like hen's teeth. This is exactly the thing I talk about in this book. We've actually had a huge shortage of very high-end skilled trades. And
yes,
it goes back to the educational system. Because when I was out on construction sites all the time, I'm going to guess that 20% of the people I worked with were either dyslexic, autistic, or ADHD. And
yeah,
you know what's happening? They're not getting replaced. And that's
yes,
why roofers are like hen's teeth. But right now, what's happening is these kids are getting going in special ed. They're getting addicted to video games. They're growing up never using tools. And we can't find people to fix things. There were two bad things that we did in our educational system 20, 25 years ago, was shutting down the shop classes. The other thing is a lot of the industry, and I have to talk about the meat industry because that's what I know the most about. And I don't think the meat industry is the only industry that made this mistake. 20 years ago, they shut down in-house engineering and in-house equipment building capability. Because in the short run, it was cheaper just to farm it out. Local shops, you're not talking about importing from another country. They have local shops build things. But now as those shops have retired out, you see the little new shops are not forming. And right now, I've got a piece of equipment called the center track restrainer system I developed in the 80s and the early 90s. And it needs some repairs now. And also cattle have gotten really fat and has to be widened. There's one shop left. They are gouging 5 times the cost it should be. Like right now, this is really serious. The other thing that's really serious is if you want to build a new poultry processing plant, you're going to get the equipment from Holland. All the equipment's coming from Holland. A lot of stuff's coming from Italy. And then I go back and I look at the educational system in Holland and Italy. And this is why they're making that equipment. I am a welfare board for a major company in Canada. And I got a video tour of the latest chicken plant. All the equipment inside comes from Holland. So I go look up the education for Italy and Holland. And they don't stick their nose up at the skilled trades the way we do. You can go a tech track in about ninth grade, and the kids are about 12, 14. And it's gorgeous equipment. My animal welfare hat is jumping up and down for joy. And my educator hat is throwing a gigantic fit. Just 2 days ago, I went on a video tour of a brand new plant just opened in Canada. Beautiful. The equipment's all from Holland. You see, there's a link here, and we're paying for it big time. I've been on a lot of elevators in the last 6 months that need service, skipping floors, scraping, doors aren't working right because they're not fixing them. So I've been doing like a gray hair survey on escalator repair and elevators. And I went to a major airport in the U.S. 2 weeks ago. 4 guys working on an escalator, all ripped apart. Conveyors that look like they came out of the meatpacking plant industry. And 3 out of 4 are gray. That is an issue. And I can talk about that. I'm gray now.
It's absolutely fantastic to have you on the podcast. And it's great to jump in like that because for the listeners, visual thinking is a really big
right
deal
here
for people with dyslexia. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you in. Temple Grandin has written this book called Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. And I really wanted to showcase this book and showcase Temple Grandin and hear, you know, a bit more about visual thinking and maybe connecting it with dyslexia and,
hear
some of your experiences in the background. So give the listeners a bit of an overview of your story. You know, where did it all begin with this visual thinking book? What woke you up to writing it?
The thing that woke me up to writing this book was trips I took in 2019, because this book was my COVID lockdown project.
Ah.
I was grounded for a year. I'm a senior. I didn't dare fly. But right before COVID lockdown, I went to a brand new poultry plant, two brand new pork plants, equipment all came mostly from Holland, and the Steve Jobs Theater, structural glass walls from Italy and Germany. And I would go, we've got a problem here. And then I went back through all the projects I've worked on, because I've been in this industry now 50 years.
What industry is that?
The meat industry.
Okay.
Okay. And I have been involved with building equipment in the industry for a long time. You're building big Cargill plants, your other big plants being built. I was out on these jobs, out on major construction projects, supervising my equipment being put in. You want to see the stuff I work on, you will go, beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin.
And great, we'll put it into the show notes.
So I went back to all the projects that I had done where I'd spent considerable time with different people. And these were people that took a single welding class in high school, started a tiny shop, and some of the shops grew really big. Some of them didn't get so big. And 20% of these people that were designing, making, and inventing complicated mechanical equipment with autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD, undiagnosed, but let me tell you, I can find it. I worked with a company that built feed mills, and they were working on a project with me, and the whole family was dyslexic. They were the visual thinkers who can't do algebra. A lot of these people cannot do algebra. And in the U.S., that's a barrier to graduation from high school. In some cases, it would be a barrier to taking that welding class.
Oh, really? You
yes.
need to have algebra to do welding.
But you don't. And I think there's algebra you need for certain things.
Yes.
Chemistry, physics, yes. Orbital mechanics, yes, you need algebra. But if you are just building equipment, you don't.
Yeah.
Because another guy I worked with, now he's not autistic, but he started with a single welding class like 35 years ago. He has a gigantic construction company and a corporate jet now. Now he's not autistic, but he absolutely can't do algebra.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another guy I know, he stutters, horrible student, dyslexic, really socially awkward. He took two classes in high school, woodworking, which he hated, and welding that he loved. And he started making some equipment. I can't say what it is because they're not formally diagnosed. Now he sells it all around the world, and he's very proud of his patents. And he made big posters out of them and decorated this place with them.
Fantastic. So tell me about your visual thinking book.
In my visual thinking book, I start right out on the issue of skill loss. That's right in the first chapter, the trip I just told you about. Then the next chapter is the science that shows that different kinds of thinking exist. See, there's some people in education who call that conjecture. I have a lot of studies. Now, you take your kid that's your average kid. It might not matter whether you use phonics or you use whole word, teach math, or teach reading. But you get the kid that's really different. They might be an extreme object visualizer like me, where everything I think about is a picture. We can't do algebra, but we're good at mechanical things, art, photography, and animals. Or you can get a person that's an extreme mathematician. They're your programmers. Boy, there's a lot of autistic programmers, but autism can come in two types of visual thinking. Object visualizers like me were terrible at algebra, or the pattern thinker, visual spatial, who's good at math, chemistry, physics, and computer programming. I tried computer programming. I could not do it. Bill Gates and I had the same exact computer to learn on, and he did it, and I had to drop the class.
Yeah.
Then I have chapters on, you know, algebra screening us out, that where these shops are not getting replaced. You know, the kids that need to be fixing those elevators are playing video games in the basement.
Yeah.
And then I have a chapter on disasters, how you need visual thinkers to see risky things that are very obvious. You see, mathematicians calculate risk. Visual thinkers can visualize something that'd be risky. And I used the example of the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The engineers did a beautiful job of making it earthquake-proof. It shook and it was just fine. 20 minutes later, the tsunami flooded the site and drowned the electric emergency cooling pump. If they had watertight doors, it would not have happened. And the thing's kind of shocking is they calculate risk. They don't see it. I'm going, oh, I tell you what's going to happen if you flood that site with a whole pile of water.
Yeah.
That pump's not going to run. It's that simple. Care if I have a generator. Electric motors don't run underwater. And you see how simple that is? And you look at it visually, I can't design a nuclear reactor. But maybe I need to work on the safety systems.
Yes.
That's the thing. You see, you need both kinds of minds. You need them working together. So then I went back to all the projects and I made a big list of all these plants I've worked on. And there's a very interesting division of labor from an engineering standpoint on building a big, complicated factory. My kind of mind makes what I call the clever engineering, mechanically clever equipment. The degreed engineer, the mathematician, he'll do the boilers and refrigeration, the stuff that requires more math. People I worked with, they never touched boilers or refrigeration. We didn't understand it because, you see, that's mathematical. And I saw that division of engineering labor every job that I worked, every single one of them.
Yeah. In the Dyslexic Advantage, they mention, they call it dynamic reasoning, the ability to reason dynamically. So you can imagine a situation, not only imagine it, you can imagine and understand the mechanical flow of the situation, how gravity will work, how water will work.
Oh, I'm seeing water coming over the seawall right now.
Yeah.
Because I've looked at all the photographs of the site coming over the seawall, flooding the site. I can see it back going against the seawall, gonna hold the water on the site, steel doors busting out, standard steel doors.
That's right.
The thing that I didn't visualize is that they had fish swimming. Yeah.
So what else have you got in the book? What's next?
I also have a chapter on kind of neurodiversity movement, and I do a lot of talks to big businesses. I've done a lot of Zoom calls, tech companies, steel companies, banks, and I explain to them, you need these different kinds of minds. Okay. And now, of course, a bank would have a lot of jobs that would be the computer type, more mathematical things. There's a lot of people with autism are mathematical. But you take an oil company or a steel mill. I told the people at the steel mill, I'm going to bet you if I went out in your maintenance shop, I'm not going to find enough young people to keep your mill running. You need these skills. And it goes back to the educational system. I had a lot of fun just the other day online. I looked up the Italian system and they even, you know, put a kind of an art route into it too. And the thing is that when I first started, I didn't know that other people bought it verbally. When I first started my career, when I was in my 20s, I did not know that. I thought everybody thought in pictures. And then I asked a speech therapist to think about something like a church steeple. I see PowerPoint slides of specific ones. And speech therapist just saw two lines like that.
Yeah.
Almost no visual thinking. I was shocked. And then I go through the research where the verbal thinker tends to overgeneralize with big concepts. But how do you actually implement those concepts? My mind's bottom up. And I'm going to do something a lot more local.
So what's the final message of your book?
The final message of my book is that we need these visual minds. And if we shunt them into special ed, so they play video games in the basement, we're going to have a lot of problems with infrastructure, with really important stuff.
Yes,
that's
I totally agree.
That is the bottom line. And you need us people that can't do algebra. You need us.
Yeah. Yes, and, absolutely.
And that's the bottom line of the book.
Yes. So educationally, these roots have been removed and all that's left is for the children to carry on working in the word orientated, algebra orientated.
They haven't taken out the mathematical.
Yeah.
But basically we need the skills. And then when I look at the countries that are making equipment now, I've gone shopping for a lot of equipment too. What's happening in the US right now, some school states are putting the hands-on classes back in.
Yes.
They're starting to kind of put them back in now. And I hope this book accelerates that trend. But there's a tendency They used to say here, well, stupid kids take shop and become things like welders. And I'm going, I worked on very large, complicated factory projects with people that barely graduated from high school. And let me tell you, they're not stupid. It's a different kind of intelligence.
Let me tell you a story. I didn't do very well at school up until the age of 14 because of my dyslexia. I didn't know I was dyslexic until the teacher told me the rules of the game for exams. And I played the game and I managed to get some very good exam results, some of the highest in the country. And then I went to law school, Edinburgh Law School. And 3 years into law school, I decided the law isn't for me. I don't really want to do this. I stopped and I told my mom and dad, I want to become a joiner, a woodworker. I want to be able to build houses. Okay. And they're like, what on earth are you doing throwing away a law degree for becoming a joiner? And I said, I don't care. I've tried to please you, tried to please everybody, but this is the one thing I want to do. So I spent a year and a half satisfying that core desire to get stuff done, to make things, to build things, to finish things. And once I'd done the year and a half of that joinery, I went back and I finished my law degree.
Okay.
And since I finished my law degree, I then went and learned to be a teacher. And those three things, law degree, joiner, teacher, all three of those skills have combined as a thread throughout my life and been extremely helpful in all sorts of ways. And I think there's something so undervalued about the practical aspect of getting things done. And there's a lot of people who only do part of a job. They theoretically talk about this sort of thing, right, and then they pass it on to someone else and they don't get the full feedback loop of maybe they got that quite wrong or whatever. They don't get that feedback loop in some organizations. Whereas if you've got the beginning and the end in front of you and you make a mistake, you get the feedback, you adjust, you develop it, you improve it, and you get real results. And I think that's something that's often undervalued.
I'd agree with that.
You know?
I totally agree with that. And you get into very, okay, let's be the verbal thinker, overgeneralize it, some concept like having an inclusive classroom or something like that. Or I talk to a lot of big corporations and they say, talk about being inclusive. I said, you need these skills. It's not just a matter of, you know, being nice. You need these skills. You need the skills of people like me who can't do algebra.
What other things can't you do? Because one of the things I noticed is that, okay, the company might then say, yeah, okay, yeah, let's be inclusive. Let's include them. Let's get some different thinkers in. And they come into the organization and then they realize, oh, hold on a minute. We've just included them in the organization, but they don't submit the document that I asked them to fill in. They don't submit a business plan or a memo about that. They haven't written a plan or whatever. We've got to have this. Otherwise, you can't
fit in. Let's just where minds work together.
All that?
Let's talk about different kinds of minds working together. This book, I have a co-author, Betsy Lark. She is a word thinker, totally linear. I would do the rough draft of the chapter, and then she'd reorganize it. So we're recognizing our different skills. And I learned a lot about verbal thinking that kind of, you know, blew my mind. But she tends to take out too much detail. I have too much detail. My thinking is associative. It's not linear.
Yes.
And so the two of us work together using complementary skills. Let's go back to the factory. My kind of mind doesn't work on boilers and refrigeration. Plant has to have that. But right now, we can build a building, put the refrigeration system in, but we don't have all the clever equipment. And what's happening is in some schools, and they're starting now to realize they're going to need to change this, is I've talked to kids that have failed three algebra classes. They want to be a veterinary technician. You don't need a veterinary nurse. You don't need algebra for that. There's a few formulas you need for dosing drugs, but those can be just memorized. I can do that.
Yes.
You memorize five or six formulas you use for dosing drugs. I can do that. There's formulas for sizing hydraulic cylinders. I can do that. But the algebra in the abstract makes no sense to me.
Here's an interesting scenario to add to that. In order to get to be a veterinary nurse, for example, here in the UK, you need to have had high school maths, and high school English as a pass, okay? You could have got an A in biology, an A in chemistry, an A in all sorts of other things that are more relevant to being a vet nurse than a pass in English. But you could maybe just not quite pass the English. And a lot of people get stopped at these gateways.
That's in the US too.
With English and maths, maths often isn't the issue. Often basic maths is covered, but then the English, I've noticed a lot of children think that they're getting actually marked on their spelling and their grammar and that sort of form, the form of the English. And they are, but actually only about 30% of the marks go to that. There's a whole other aspect of passing an English exam, which is about how have you organized the information and structured it with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And often children, well, I just finished, so that's an end. But once they start to actually think, oh, this is like a machine. This has got component parts.
Okay.
I can actually visualize the content and the mechanics of this story or this essay. And they concentrate on the mechanics of the story and they put their effort into that rather than improving their English, their spelling and grammar. Their spelling and grammar might still give them low marks out of that 30% band, but the 50%, which is about organization of the story, they might end up getting 80% of that component part and get them above the pass. But the school training is so obsessed with the outer form and the English particularities that they just assume that the children will bolt together a decent story under the hood. They don't actually spend a whole heap of time on the story building mechanics, for example.
The way I learned writing, because I was a reporter for a magazine for 7 years. Wow. And okay, the way I learned writing, diagramming a sentence made no sense to me. The teachers just marked at my work and then I would go and correct it. And then the other thing is I was raised in a family where English was spoken correctly. So I'd read something out loud and I go, wait a minute, mother wouldn't say he learned me to read. It would be he taught me to read. And I just learned it by, does it sound right? And I've had right now graduate students whose writing skills are just terrible. And I mark up their papers like I'm in high school English class. And I find out they've never written a book report, which I think is a very important thing to learn how to do because you've got to summarize, then critique it. It's also relatively short. And the other thing I suggested to my students to do, and I do this sometimes, is read your paper out loud.
Yes.
Like a speech.
Yes.
And I was a terrible student in high school, but my ninth grade English, in terms of just writing up sort of technical stuff, is better than a lot of my graduate students today. And I'm finding out that nobody marked up their work. They didn't write term papers. And
really?
Yeah. And I've talked to a lot of professors about this. And in the last 10 years, and I've been a professor now for 31 years, it's gotten worse. And I've talked to professors at many other schools. They'll tell me the same thing. Yeah. I said, am I just some old fogey now that I'm in my 70s? No. And I've talked to younger professors too.
Yeah. Tell me about your professor work.
I'm a professor of animal science, and my main work has been cattle behavior. And some of the very early work I did, it was radical stuff back in the early 90s, and did a very simple experiment with my first graduate student, Bridget Wozenay, and she did the study. And the hypothesis was very simple. We have to put cattle in what you call crushes, squeeze chutes, you know, restrainer devices to hold them for vaccinations and other treatments. And the hypothesis was simple. Cattle that jump all around and fight the squeeze chute, rather than just standing there quietly, will have lower weight gains. It turned out to be true. And now that started selecting cattle for calmer temperaments. 30 years ago, that was real radical stuff. That was one of my first studies. I did a study just recently with Megan Corrigan, one of my students, on horse perception. And I've always said that animals think in it's sensory-based, smell, sounds, images. So we walked horses, or rather it was that my students did. They did all the work. Passed a little toy playset, that little colorful plastic playset for a toddler with a swing and a slide on it. And they took a young Holderbrook Colts and Phillies, walked them by the playset till they no longer stopped. They no longer put the head up and they no longer flared their nostrils. Then when the playset was rotated, it became a new object. Think about it. All right, we'll use this book as a proxy for a slide. See how the children's slide would look different? Became a new object. Now, if that had been done at a gallop, the rider would have been dumped off. That's one of my more recent studies, and it's proved something I've been saying for years. I really like that paper.
Right.
Yeah. Those are some of the things
institution that I've do you work done. At?
Department of Animal Hold Science, on. Colorado State University. That's where I work. And I did another study at a student go out and look at how mama cows protect their calves. And we found that there were differences in that. You know, a lot of kind of applied practical kind of research things that I do.
And what would you say is your kind of the makeup of your mind? Would you say are you neurodiverse yourself? Are you?
I'm autistic. I'm autistic.
You're autistic.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I am definitely autistic.
Right.
No speech and delays four. I have other books about this, Thinking in Pictures, that I did 25 years ago. I am definitely neurodiverse. I'm autistic, very definitely. But I think completely in pictures. And if you watch the HBO movie Temple Grandin, there's a scene in there where a whole bunch of shoe pictures. I said the word shoe, and a whole bunch of shoes come up. You know, everything is like Google for images. And it's also associative.
Okay, so you don't see one universal
examples of shoes.
Yes.
All right, right now I'm going through my boot collection right now. In my mind. And I'm seeing
how many do you
really
see in your mind?
Pair of boots that I wear out at the farm. Now I'm seeing some warm socks that I sleep in. Now that's not a shoe. But you see, that's associated with something you put on a foot.
Yes.
I was cold last night. I have electric heating. It doesn't work very well. And I was cold last night. And I was really glad I had these like woolly socks I could wear to bed. And then I have another more raggedy pair that I travel with that are white and gray. I'm seeing.
And it's interesting because I'm not autistic. I'm dyslexic, and I would say I'm quite a visual thinker, but I have a different kind of visual thinking. I don't see specific examples when I'm visualizing something. When I'm visualizing something, I don't actually see a picture of it. I don't see the colors of it. I see more like a blueprint, more like a sketch outline, more like the feeling of the shape of it rather than
picture. That's not how my mind works.
Yeah.
No. And then algebra was just hopeless. I was terrible at foreign languages. And that's because I've got some auditory processing problems and I don't hear sound detail very well.
Well, I did a podcast earlier, we'll put it in the show notes, of a man who was a truck driver, bus driver. And he didn't do so well at school. He ended up doing busing and trucking.
Yeah.
And he ended up working in the shop repairing the engines.
Yes.
And then someone said to him, you know, you're pretty good with engines. Why didn't you go into engineering or something like that? And he said, I would have loved to, but I didn't do very well. And he found out he was dyslexic. And then he ended up going to university. He ended up getting some assistance for his dyslexia there, and he did really well in his degree. And now he designs motorcycle engines. And so he's gone. How many people are there, do you think, in this world who are those kind of mechanics who are working on an engine, looking at it, saying, I could have built this engine better than the designer?
Oh, yeah.
And then if they had been given the ability at school to go up to the level of their ability to design things, they would be like this guy actually in designing the engine in the end. But so many of them get locked off at that, oh, you're just the mechanic who fixes it afterwards.
Oh,
and he's
pulling
out a filter saying, why on earth is that filter there when it should have been here? And there's no reason for it to be in the wrong place. No one's thought this through properly.
But the thing that's happened in my industry is I've seen people come in, get a job on the line in a meat plant, gravitate over to the maintenance department. This is the back door. They don't go to university. And then 15 years later, they're in charge of building a new plant addition. And yes, the other thing I've seen happen when the plants had in-house engineering, they used to have this company called Moffitt's. They don't exist anymore. And they had this gigantic machine shop called the Moffitt Fab Shop. And they built a lot of my stuff. And there was lots of stuff patented, all done by shop guys that barely graduated from high school. And then sometimes the degreed engineers put their names first on the patents. That made me really angry. But there were people out there. I had a lot of my stuff built by people that barely graduated from high school.
Yes. And your point, I loved your point about how important it is to have this vertical stack of a staff where making stuff in-house and it's being built in-house and then it's being put together in-house and then it's being sold so that everyone in-house is seeing the consequences and the feedback loops there rather than separating it all out.
Here's all my drawings right here. These are drawings of facilities I designed.
Okay.
The way I sold jobs was to show up drawings I had done of facilities. Another thing I found in my industry is we'd hire somebody to be a draftsman. I know one guy, now he was not autistic, but he had took a one semester class in computer drafting. And he took his homework assignment into the Moffitt Fab Shop. And he was hired. And this guy laid out entire beef plants. I worked with him.
Wow.
Yes. You see, this is, and then you see when they shut down these in-house things, every time I drive by the Moffitt Fab Shop, I cry. They tore out all the equipment and they fixed trucks in there now. And the people that own it now are not responsible for shutting it down. That was a previous owner. But it was a gigantic mistake to shut it down. And there's other similar things that have happened in other companies on shutting down in-house engineering. And the other problem is we don't have the kids graduating from welding classes where they can start little tiny shops. Because I worked with another person, started as a tiny steel shop.
Yes.
30 years later, corporate jet, big, huge construction projects.
And it's still possible now.
He's just a high school graduate.
And you look at what Elon Musk is doing in terms of another autistic.
He's got amazing engineering stuff.
He's really doing this vert engineering stack as well.
Oh, he's doing great engineering stuff. Wonderful.
Yes.
Garland's a fabulous technology.
Can you give me your opinion on this? One of the guests was saying the importance of prototyping and with children right from the beginning. If they've got an idea as a young child, parent, his advice was go and get some cardboard, go and get something get that out there and prototype it, get it out their head.
I would agree
so they
with
can
that.
See and it, some play with it. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Now, this is why I did this little book, Calling All Minds. And it has children's projects I did as a child. I tinkered and tinkered with stiff drawing paper to make little bird kites. Oh, yeah, yes, I definitely believe in prototyping before you go to the expense of building a whole bunch of stuff.
Absolutely. And I think for young people and even adults, I think this concept of iterative design where you do a quick, small mock-up of something.
Yes.
And then you think that's a minimum viable product. Okay, great. That kind of worked. Live with it for a wee while. And then you upgrade it a little bit. You make it out of cardboard first. Then you make it out of wood. And then you make it out of steel. And
that's
it becomes
right.
Something more permanent. And every time you do it, it gets slightly better. It adjusts to the reality of using
it.
Well,
the kind of stuff I do, they're not going to give you that much. I can make something out of cardboard or something that's tacked together in the shop. You know, try it a little bit, and then I got to get the real one built.
Yes.
They're going to push you harder. Yeah, but that's a concept that I definitely believe in.
I think it's good for young people. I think
young people should be doing. That's why I did this book, Calling All Minds, because we got kids growing up today that have never made a paper airplane. They've never used a ruler. They've never used scissors. So if they want to become doctors, they have a difficult time learning how to sew up cuts because they've never used scissors.
So, Temple Grandin, what other books and resources have you made? You keep pulling out these different. Give us a quick overview of all the things you've done.
Too. Here's Improving Animal Welfare, Practical Approach.
Brilliant.
That's all about livestock.
Great.
Pigs on the cover there. I take a real practical approach. Let's take something like animal welfare. You get into a whole lot of theory, but now we've got auditors out there inspecting farms, and you've got to have very simple, straightforward guidelines where you can train somebody in a day and a half workshop, because that's the commercial reality. And if I go in there and their sows are really skinny and I can see their vertebrae bumps, you've got sows that are too skinny. It's that simple.
Yeah.
Or they're light, and their scoring system for measuring that. I'm not into theory. How can we practically apply something?
Okay. You're into the practical application of theory. So it's good theory, but it's the practical application.
I am into the practical application. Absolutely.
Practical application of good theory. And I think that's the interesting dynamic. So here's a key thing about visual thinking that sometimes people, I think, misunderstand it. Sometimes they think visual thinking is about fantasy, imagination, new stories, but it's not always. That's one aspect of it. But I think, and you probably agree, I hope, is that visual thinkers are on this hunt for imagining things, visualizing things, but making sure what they visualize is properly calibrates to the reality of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're constantly calibrating.
Absolutely.
It.
I mean, I'm not going to visualize building a cattle handling facility out of tissue paper, because that's not going to work.
I now see
the cattle just busting through it.
Yes. You're also going to visualize the flow of the cattle in a certain way.
Yes, I visualize that.
And then you're going to say to yourself, right, I think this is the right way of the cattle going through. They go through it and you see something's not quite as you visualized it, or you maybe do a slight adjustment, etc. And what you're always doing, I think, visual people, is doing something and think, yeah, I was pretty spot on that. And then reality gives you this cognitive feedback and you go, ah, right, that's interesting. And you adjust slightly in the next one and you adjust. And there's this beautiful flow of what's in your mind and also in reality, and that gearbox between the two is visual thinking.
And this is our job this spring, is a lot of this equipment is outside. And can get time of day effects with shadows. In fact, my student, Dennis Wilson, has a nice paper online showing how shadows change. Now, this is a shadow I call the spider monster right here. That's a shadow in a cattle handling facility. A big one, a real big one. And when it was in the morning, that shadow was not there. It worked wonderful. And then at 3 o'clock or 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I call that the spider monster, that shadow appeared. It's from the overhead structure. And when the sun moved, it made that shadow appear. And it was absolutely horrible. And they had to build a roof over it to get rid of that.
Right. And that's a perfect example.
That was not there at 10 o'clock in the morning.
And what would you say that's an example of?
I took one look at it, and I watched these Angus cattle go up, and we're not walking over that. And I said, we're going to have to build a roof over it, or you have to take down the overhead structure. But they had a gate that would probably break if they took that overhead structure down, so they built a roof over it. But that's
did the other people see it?
People don't see it. Okay, at that same plant, I went out there for one day and I found the spider monster, but they had another thing because they run a night shift there. The cattle would come halfway up the raceway, stop. So I told the guy that worked at the plant, I said, now go out there and I want you to bring the cattle up nice and calm and watch where the leader stops and what does he look at. There was an LED light on the side of the building. They took it down.
Wow.
That was on the night shift. This stuff I just did this spring.
Wow.
And that, you see, there's a tendency for people to go, well, let's just get more yelling. Now the stupid thing that people are doing is police whistles. They jam too many cattle into the system. Now they're going after them, screaming and yelling. That's not the thing to do. You have to see where they stop. If you bring them up calm, they'll stop at the stuff they don't like. And the lead animal looked right at the LED light. They took down this LED light that was on the side of the building. This is nighttime on the night shift. And it fixed it.
That's fantastic. Now,
that's
Temple,
stuff that I'm doing right now. And the thing is, I have to really train people to see this stuff, because what happened, I was out there in the morning, is working great. Then we had lunch And we went back out there and I'm going, oh man, these cattle just won't go. I took one look at the spider monster. I said, I got to get a picture of that. That wasn't there in the morning. That pen just was all evenly lit.
Let's talk about credit, giving people credit.
Okay.
Let me just frame what my question is.
Okay.
I think sometimes visual thinkers don't get given enough credit. And I'll tell you why. And I want to hear what you think about this.
Okay.
For example, a visual thinker will come along and they'll see a scenario like you've just done there.
Yeah, the spider
and they'll spot
okay.
one little thing and they and it solves a huge problem. Okay. But it's the comment made in 30 seconds or a minute and often solved quickly. Yeah. And then you move on to something else. And then it's hold on a minute and it's never mentioned again. Oh yeah, we've got this working and so on. Then that person, their whole mind has been wired. Your whole mind has been wired to identify those little things that make a huge difference.
Oh,
when they get solved, sometimes you get no credit because you're like, oh yeah, we just fixed that and that was fine. But actually, if you hadn't come into that scenario, it could have been a big issue.
I think people are often not given credit. And this has happened with shop people working in a shop. Usually not high school graduates or maybe not a high school graduate, inventing equipment in the shop and not getting credit for it. That's a sore topic with me.
And tell us more about it.
Unfortunately, I've got equipment where a shop guy was not first author on a patent and should have been. The degreed engineer was first author on the patent. I think I will leave out what patent it is. But I think about that patent, it makes me angry. Because the shop person should have been first author on the patent. Yes, I would agree with not getting credit.
I think this is something, a practical application of this is for parents, okay?
Yes.
At home, sometimes, let's say Billy, you know, might misbehave a little bit at school, play up, not do so well, you know, forget to bring his school kit to work.
Yeah.
To school at the right time, a bit scatterbrained and so on. And you come on, Billy, get with the game, get with the script. But then Billy sees something at home and then mom, you know, he says, you know, if we moved the wheelie bin or the bins over here a little bit, that might be better for your back. Or if we did this, if we did that, and you go, oh, okay, Billy, we'll move it. And then it works. And then nothing more is said, you know. But if you then counterbalance all of the things that Billy's not doing so well. Fine, he's not doing them so well. But you go, hey, Billy told us about moving the wheelie bin over to this side here, and it's really helped my back. And it's Billy did this. Tiny little things, it builds up Billy's
and
sense
these little
of self-worth.
Tiny little things matter because I've seen similar things in factories. Little tweaks made on equipment that made a really big difference. And it doesn't get enough credit. When I was doing the book signing for Visual Thinking, we had a big book tour starting on October 11th. They often used a school for my talk because they didn't have enough space in the bookstore. So I went out to school in California and I visited with the principal. And I was shocked. This is like a month ago. Shocked to discover that the principal did not even know that people thought visually. He started quizzing me about how I think. That's a month ago in California. And I think some of the algebra stuff is, I think there's some people that think that algebra teaches logical thought. Doesn't teach me any logical thought. This principal of a very nice private school didn't even know what thinking in pictures. And the scientific term for me is an object visualizer. And then the mathematical line is visual spatial. And there's a whole chapter in visual thinking just on the research. No, it's not conjecture. I've got pun, even though somebody called the book conjecture. It is backed in science. I have a very extensive reference list.
Temple Grandin, it's been absolutely fantastic interviewing you. I think I'd like to give you the last, you know, 5 minutes or so, or whatever you want. So what is it? Is there anything else you would want to talk about or share?
The reason why I did this book, Visual Thinking, is I'm very concerned that a lot of very talented kids are getting screened out, shunted in special ed, and they go, oh, they're special ed. They can't use tools. And in my career, I worked with a lot of brilliant people that barely graduated from high school, but took a welding class that were inventing complicated mechanical equipment. Well, I call it the clever engineering department. And they're all old like me now. And they are not getting replaced. They don't stick their nose up at the high-end skilled trades. You know, the kids in Italy, a lot of equipment's coming from Italy. You can look up a thing called the Apollo chicken harvester, very clever piece of equipment. And these getting screened out. And I'm very concerned about the skill loss, where we don't have people to fix elevators and escalators. I don't really want to get stuck in an elevator. And I hear scraping noises. They haven't straightened the thing that goes, you know, the things that the track way they should. We're losing skills. But I also want to see the kids that are different, not ending up on a disability check playing video games. Well, they ought to be having a lot more fun building things. In fact, we've had some successes on getting young adults off of video games with car mechanics. And they found that engines were a lot more interesting than video games. A lot of these kids, I think, would find elevators more interesting than video games. We need the skills. And some of the best parts of my life were working on these big projects, working on inventing and designing equipment. So two things, the skill loss, but I also want to see the kids that are different, whether they're autistic, dyslexic, ADHD, get into good careers where they can really contribute to society. And I'm concerned that us people like me who can't do algebra, we're just getting screened out. I wouldn't be able to graduate high school today. So how would I get in the back door? Let's say somebody waved a magic wand and I'm 18 years old now, come out of a low-income background. I've just failed my third algebra class, can't graduate. What would I do? Let's say they let me keep my knowledge. Oh, they're building a new semiconductor plant in Ohio. That's where I would go. And I'm going to pay my dues on that floor. Because you know what my goal is? I want to design the next one. You need the people who can't do algebra.
Yes.
Okay.
What a wonderful, wonderful way to finish it, Temple Grandin. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
No, it was really great. And I hope your roofing goes well. But your experience with the roofing, we can't get people to fix stuff